Bad financial decisions, we've all made them, and the economic year that was from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 27th of December. Thanks for being with us. It's been a relatively quiet few days for business. We'll get to some of the news that still managed to happen during a holiday week in a bit. But first, given it's the last Friday of the year and the decade, depending which side of that whole debate you're on, we're going to do something a little different on our weekly wrap. We've got Nela Richardson with Edward Jones and Gina Smilek of the New York Times with us from New York to help us tie it all up in a neat little bow. Hi, you two.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, Amy.
Gina, let's start with you. And I actually want to look ahead to the coming year and the Fed. We've got the annual musical chairs coming up in the interest rate setting committee, the FOMC. What do you think that means for interest rates?
You know, I think it's interesting. I've seen a couple of stories out over the last couple of days suggesting that you could see some more consensus, just given a couple of the folks who are rotating onto the Federal Open Market Committee. But I think at the end of the day, what we really saw in 2019 is that Chair Jerome Powell managed to kind of convince the rest of the committee to come around to his way of viewing the world. You know, we did see some dissents this year, but by the end of the year, people were really sounding pretty comfortable with the decisions the Fed had made, even people who had dissented throughout the year, like Eric Rosengren and Esther George, two of the regional presidents, were sounding more comfortable with where rates were currently set. And so I think what you can expect in 2020 is perhaps a more united front, and also a lot of sort of careful watching to see what comes next. We don't clearly know whether that's going to be a rate hike or a rate cut or just an extended pause.
And I'm not going to make you predict. Nela, what kind of economy do you think this next panel is inheriting in the new year?
Well, the good news is that they are unlikely to inherit a probability or a high probability of a recession, though the economy is likely to slow next year versus this year. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The first and foremost is that we're not going to get that boost from the tax cuts. That's basically worn off the 2018 tax cut. So we're seeing an economy that will tread along about at average for the decade, but not pick up much steam.
So we got an early look this week at holiday retail so far. We saw record online shopping and in-store sales also up a bit, according to MasterCard. One thing we've been talking about a lot on the show is you know, the American consumer basically keeping this economy going. Gina, are there signs of that continuing next year?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, consumers are clearly still feeling good. The confidence numbers look solid. What we saw in these sort of early holiday retail spending numbers is a really robust performance, considering that we saw another year of growth after sort of a decade of economic expansion. You know, this has been a really long period of sustained economic growth. Consumers have powered it through sort of from the beginning. And I think we're really seeing that continue. I think what's really interesting looking into 2020, though, is whether those consumers can keep up that much steam and continue to sort of be the one leg propping the economy up in a world where businesses don't look super robust and aren't spending really aggressively.
Nela, thoughts about that?
Well, absolutely. I think Jenna hit it right on the nail there. But the question also is how the business side will respond to low interest rates. We haven't seen that pickup in investment that you would expect with rates this low. So the economy really has two superpowers right now. One is the consumer that's been resilient through all kinds of geopolitical tensions, through political tensions, through pretty much a recession in manufacturing. And, you know, we have an economy that's being subsidized by very low interest rates at decade lows, but a business sector that's not responding. So that very slow growth that's keeping interest rates low, matched with a resilient consumer, pushes the economy forward, but just at a slower pace.
So as we wrap up this decade, I want to give each of you in about a minute we have left a chance to talk about anything that stood out to you or that still you think about this decade in the economy.
Well, so many things have happened in this decade. I feel like most of them happened in the last year and a half, to be honest. But one thing that
it's been a long year.
There's been a lot. But one thing that I think that has been consistent from the beginning, the way this decade started to the way it ends, is the word housing. It's something that we don't talk a lot about in the media, but this decade was born out of a housing crisis, and we enter the next decade with housing still wounded and broken. So it's going to define, I think, that the economy for a lot of folks out there, even if it's underreported.
And how about you, Gina?
Mine's a slightly different take, I think, probably because I sit on the reporter side. But I think the labor market has really been a super interesting story throughout this decade. And if there's one moment that really defines that for me, I think it's the speech Janet Yellen gave in October of 2016, where she's basically sort of laid out a case for why running the economy a little bit hot might sort of change the labor market's potential outcomes, and explained that, you know, in a world with very low interest rates and very low unemployment, you might see workers jump back into the labor market. She never really wholeheartedly embraced that doctrine, but I think that it has a flavor of what we saw the Fed actually practically do, and it certainly is what actually happened.
All right, Gina Smilek of the New York Times, Nela Richardson with Edward Jones, thanks so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Happy New Year.
For me, what stands out from the decade was the day I was filling in for Kai in February 2018, and the Dow had its biggest point drop in history, more than 1,100 points. We all had visions of 2008 flashing before our eyes. Today, though, was nothing like that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tesla is set to start delivering cars made at its new factory in China on Monday, with the very first models going to employees. Tesla only started building what it calls Gigafactory 3 about a year ago. That speed tells you something about how important car sales in China are, and not just to Tesla. As Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, car makers are competing for a bigger slice of the world's largest market.
A car fan visiting Shanghai for the first time is likely to be struck by how many luxury cars there are, says Michael Dunn, CEO of ZozoGo, an advisory group on Asian car markets.
China's luxury car market is twice the size of the U.S. market and getting bigger every year. And that's the market that Tesla has its eye on.
He says there's also demand for electric vehicles.
China is now the largest EV market in the world, accounting for 60% of global sales.
By 2025, China plans to build 5 million electric vehicles a year, he says. To tap that market without incurring import tariffs that nearly double the price of its cars, Tesla had to build a local factory. Which is an important step for China, too, because this is the first fully foreign-owned car plant, says Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions.
Previously, if you build a car plant in China, you had to have a joint venture partner in China.
Now there's a shift by Chinese authorities to open up the car market, something that will be welcomed by U.S. manufacturers, says auto consultant Rebecca Lindland.
Even though there's been some stagnation in the volume right now, the potential is just enormous.
But there's no guarantee other automakers will be able to follow Tesla's path. Its cars do check both the EV and luxury boxes. But with over 90% of all cars sold in China being built there, many foreign vehicle manufacturers will be looking at Tesla's factory as a model. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
In the age of the streaming wars, you almost need a spreadsheet to keep track of all the different services and which ones are worth paying for. And there's another one coming soon. NBC Universal is preparing to launch Peacock next April. To that end, its parent company, Comcast, is reportedly in talks to buy another free streaming service, Xumo. That could help Comcast make good on its plans to launch Peacock, or at least a version of it, as a free ad-supported service, like good old-fashioned TV. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Viewers have always looked for variety on TV, says Michael Pachter, an analyst with Wedbush Securities.
You know, I think about it like I think about eating out, because sometimes you want Mexican food, and sometimes you want chicken, and sometimes you want seafood.
In the old days, they got that in one place, Vegas buffet style, first over the air, then with a cable package, and eventually on the big streaming services, Netflix and Hulu, which offered content from all of the studios and networks.
Until the media companies noticed that people were cutting the cord. And the content guys have now pulled back all their content, and they're saying, we're going to do it ourselves.
Hence, NBC Universal's Peacock and Disney Plus, CBS All Access, Fubo.
Crunchyroll, it's an anime-based service. There's also Funimation Now, also an anime service.
Brett Sappington of Parks Associates Consumer Analytics tracks the more than 300 streaming options available in the U.S.
There are services related to cooking, astronomy, boating, horses, really a wide, wide variety.
That makes it harder than ever to stand out from the crowd. Sappington says streaming services can do that with really catchy original content, like Disney's Star Wars hit The Mandalorian, or by being cheap or free because they're supported by advertising.
It's a model that's worked for about 70 years.
And media consultant Brad Adgate thinks it could keep working as more of those second- and third-tier streaming services vie for advantage. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
It's been nearly 2 months since hundreds of thousands of protesters first took to the streets in Lebanon, calling for political change. But the situation has only worsened, with the country facing its worst economic crisis since the end of the Civil War in 1990 and having no functioning government. The BBC's Tim Huell reports from Beirut.
Living in Lebanon means battling blackouts day in, day out, for years on end. The state can barely supply half the energy its citizens want. But some people find ways to keep their lights on during the outages by hooking up to private generators or, illegally, to neighbouring areas which still have state electricity.
With all these wires, and some of them have got chopped-off ends just dangling immediately above our heads, you know, aren't there a lot of accidents? Don't a lot of people get electrocuted?
Well, it happens all the time that people get electrocuted.
But even those who try to switch between power sources, legal or illegal, sometimes end up in the dark. And in one house I'm being taken to, that can be a matter of life and death.
Hello. OK, so there's an oldish man with a grey beard here, lying on the sofa. He really doesn't go up very well, and he's got tubes here going into his nose, well, going into a big canister of oxygen here.
Aisa Rashid has suffered from lung failure for the past 5 years. He and his son, Issam, live in permanent terror of losing power.
So these are oxygen machines, electric machines. They provide him with the oxygen. But because the electricity goes off, and it goes off, and he doesn't have oxygen, he'll die in seconds.
Oh, I see. So these things here that you can hear humming, these are the electric-operated oxygen machines. So this big metal canister, big metal bottle behind, that's in case the electricity fails.
True.
The lights have just gone off. As we speak.
No worries.
Has this gone off?
No worries.
The machine's gone off? Oh, they have. So now he's turning the button on the emergency metal oxygen bottle. Yeah, and he's breathing very heavily.
It's an extreme example, but all over Lebanon, people are fed up with the blackouts, fed up with paying for the expensive private generators, fed up with a government, with a whole political system that can't provide enough power. Anger over the cuts has helped fuel the unprecedented wave of protests here over the past 2 months.
There are mafia that have been ruling this country since years and years.
Paula Yacoubian is the only independent MP in Lebanon's sectarian political system. She says the ruling elite profits from links with private suppliers and has no interest in improving state energy supply.
They're making lots of money, and that's why they keep on not fixing the electricity, so they can keep their pockets full of money. They are one of the reasons why this country, after 30 years of the end of the civil war, we still have no electricity.
I asked for an interview with Lebanon's energy minister, Nada Bustani, but she wasn't available. The government has denied corruption, and it says it will end the energy shortage by building new gas-fired power plants, cheaper and more efficient to run. But it's been promising that for years, and the protesters have lost faith. In Beirut, Lebanon, I'm the BBC's Tim Hewell for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they will be able to grab a little bit of that magic to compete in their chosen event.
The magic of a good sneaker. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 23 points, not quite a 10%, to close at 28,645. The NASDAQ lost 15 points, 0.1%, to finish at 90.06. And the S&P 500 barely budged, ending at 3,240. For the week, the Dow brought home 0.6%, the NASDAQ accelerated 0.9%, and the S&P 500 gained 0.5%. We were talking about the future of streaming. Comcast clicked up 0.2%, Netflix fell 1%. Disney was basically flat. But what about a less mainstream streaming service? AMC said this month it has 2 million subscribers across its niche offerings, including Shudder for horror fans and Acorn TV for British mystery lovers. AMC gave back 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This is it, folks. Just a couple of days left in this decade, which means time is running out to support Marketplace and make it count for this year. Any donation makes you a Marketplace investor and a partner in our mission to make people smarter about this economy. And don't forget, if you give at least $60 or a monthly donation of $5 or more, you'll get exclusive access to our 2020 Ask Me Anything virtual event series. Find out more and donate at marketplace.org. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. One of our podcasts, This is Uncomfortable, has been digging into some money horror stories. You know, the financial decisions that still haunt you, like that credit card funded trip to Europe after college, just for instance. Most of the stories have been about people buying things they eventually came to regret. But this excerpt from the latest episode is less about regret and more about, let's call it, self-discovery. Here's the host of This is Uncomfortable, Rima Kreis.
Earlier this year, Hayden Aldrin, a 23-year-old college student from Idaho, started taking this sleeping pill, a really powerful one.
It felt kind of like I was on laughing gas to a sort, which I'm a Mormon, so I've never been high before. But I imagine this is what it feels like.
For years, Hayden had trouble sleeping, and this pill felt like a godsend. He could finally get a full night's sleep. There was just one tiny drawback. When Hayden takes this sleeping pill, he does things he has zero recollection of. When he talks about it, he refers to his nighttime self as subconscious Hayden.
So not only does he, like, know what things we want to keep secret, but subconscious Hayden also likes to buy things for conscious Hayden.
In the past year, subconscious Hayden has bought awake Hayden a nice sweater, black socks, a huge bag of Airheads, and a 5-pound bag of jelly beans, just to name a few things. It's been mostly trivial stuff. Then, one evening earlier this summer, this email pops up in Hayden's inbox.
I got a notification that said, your billboard is live. And I said, my billboard is what?
No.
And I went to the confirmation link, and I had ordered a billboard in Louisville, Kentucky.
Wait, do you have any connection to Louisville?
Not at all.
So a billboard, depending on the location, can cost thousands of dollars. Hayden was panicking. What if he had completely wiped out his bank account? He looks more closely at that confirmation email, and it turns out he bought a digital billboard for relatively cheap, $100.
Seeing that it was only $100 was kind of like, whew, okay, thank goodness.
Okay, so now he just has to find out what in the world is on that billboard. He can't find any trace of it on his computer. There's no mock-up or Photoshop file. So he goes to the company's website.
So I download the image from the website, and it's just a bunch of clouds with my face on it. My face is cut out terribly, by the way. And then there was a little tiny airplane pulling a banner, and on the banner said, #endchronicfatigue tomorrow.
What?
Which is so interesting because any call to action you've ever heard is like, let's do something about this today. But mine was like, let's end chronic fatigue tomorrow.
Let's figure it out later. Wait, I need to see this image.
I can send it to you right now, actually.
Okay. Oh my God. Yeah, it's pretty much how he described it. It looks like something a middle school kid slapped together using Microsoft Paint. And Hayden has no memory of ever making it. You have like kind of a, like a I'm looking into your soul kind of look on your face. Like, I understand you. Hayden says he knows that sleeping pills can have serious side effects. There's been warnings from the FDA about people doing things like driving or getting injured sleepwalking. He hasn't consulted his doctor about it, but he has told his parents, and they aren't too worried. Hayden says the real tipping point would be if he wakes up one day and sees that subconscious Hayden has spent beyond their means and he can't return it. But he doesn't see that happening.
I know that he knows all of my anxieties about money. And, you know, he knows that I have these accruing student loans. And so I think he's more of a, not as much of a prankster, but more of a gift giver to me.
He's got your back.
Yeah.
Or he says, at least for now, he does. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
Back in October, a runner broke the two-hour mark in a marathon. And what he has in common with the winner of this year's New York City Marathon is that they both wore the same kind of Nike sneakers. The Nike Vaporfly has come under fire in recent months for possibly giving the athletes an unfair advantage. It's not the first time sports apparel has caused a stir. Kasia St. Clair tells the story in her book, The Golden Thread.
In sort of mid-2000s, there was a similar controversy around a particular kind of swimsuit. A new kind of textile had been used, which was called polyurethane. And this can have a huge effect on athletes because it compresses their bodies and creates a smoother surface. There is an advantage to a surface that compresses the flesh sufficiently so that it is less likely to ripple and bounce around. This kind of all came to a head in 2008-2009 when rafts of records fell and eventually a huge amount of pressure was put on to the governing body and they have essentially had to change the rules and this allowed, in theory, the athletes once again to reign supreme rather than what they were wearing. I think that the secret really for the brands who are involved is to create advances very incrementally, which allows both the athletes and the fans to kind of get used to these new advancements. Because, of course, you know, it's good for sports and it's good for the sportswear makers to create new records. However, it is problematic because it can be very upsetting and it can feel like the technology, the cloth technology is being showcased to the detriment of the athlete. A real impetus and what keeps these sportswear companies going are financial incentives. So if they are sponsoring athletes who are getting new records and are generating headlines, this is very good for them. It means they can then sell similar products to consumers, and maybe they're not going to break a two-hour marathon or sprint as fast as record-breaking athletes, but they will be able to grab a little bit of that magic and possibly make it a little bit easier for them to compete in their chosen event.
Is there something you've always wondered about how the economy works? We've got a series for that called I've Always Wondered, looking at the why and the how behind the what. Send us your questions at marketplace.org. This final note in other streaming news, add Spotify to the list of media companies ditching political advertising this election season. The music streaming service said today it's pausing sales of political ads on the platform because, Reuters reports, the company doesn't have what it calls the necessary level of robustness to root out misinformation in those ads. Twitter banned political ads a few months ago. So did Chinese company TikTok. Google is limiting how those ads are targeted to different groups. Over at Facebook, no changes yet. Okay, we got to go. Today, the Dow rose 23 points, not quite a 10%. The NASDAQ lost 15 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 barely budged. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.